So that's a little bit about what Catalyst does in terms of our organizing. We also do political education, so workshops, panels, trainings, stuff like that. And we do a four-month anti-racism training program called the Ann Braden Program. It's a program that has three main components. One is a four-hour workshop on Sundays. It's a political education workshop. There's one-on-one mentorship. And then the last piece is a 3 to 6 hour volunteer placement in racial justice organizations led by people of color here in the Bay Area. And we do that last piece to really drive home the point that we think that white activists doing anti-racist work really need to be learning strategies from people of color doing that work on the front lines, and also to give back to those communities who are doing that work. So collectively, the Braden participants will be giving over 2,500 hours of volunteer work to those organizations over the course of the 4 months. So. We just really are excited about the panel today. One logistical thing, if folks can turn off your cell phones or turn them down, that'd be fabulous. There goes one now. Great timing. And also, Will is here from Real TV. And if you're someone who does not want to be filmed, Will does all kinds of social justice, TV, media activism, and is filming today both for realtv.com and for the Catalyst Project. So if you're someone who doesn't want to be on film, please go ahead, raise your hand really high right now so Will can see you and not get you on film. Great. Okay, thanks. Ami, come on up.
Hey, everyone. My name is Ami. I work with the Catalyst Project, and I just want to welcome you all here today and just spend a couple minutes talking about kind of why we wanted to have this day and why we thought this panel was really important to have, both as part of the Ann Braden program, but also as an open session. So there's a couple of key kind of reasons of why we thought it was really important to do this panel. First, we really wanted to highlight some of the ways that colonization, including stolen land, theft of resources, genocide, and enslaved labor are really central to the development of what is now called the United States as a leading, expanding military and capitalist power in the world. And we also really wanted to connect this colonization to global strategies of expansion in which these same kind of methods have really been used to build capitalism historically and currently. And we see that today as the US empire continues to expand into Iraq, into Afghanistan, into Palestine, and other places. Within that context, we really wanted to understand that indigenous struggles for self-determination, the history of indigenous struggles and indigenous struggles for self-determination really continue today, and that struggle for self-determination and for sovereignty within the borders of the United States and also around the world really represent key struggles for global justice. Also, we wanted to kind of connect with that. These are real living histories. For some of us folks who are white, many of us may have kind of feelings of like guilt or shame or discomfort looking at some of these histories and thinking about their ramifications for today. Many of our families participated in or directly benefited from these histories of colonization. And these histories are part of our own families and our own histories. So we want to really acknowledge that feelings can come up. And also connect to the powerful visions of another world that so many indigenous struggles are putting forward, and the strength and resiliency within indigenous communities to continue to work towards that vision, and also to really connect to how we all can participate in supporting that work and continuing to move that vision of a just and liberated world forward. So I'm going to hand it over to Chris, who's going to introduce our panelists.
How y'all doing? So we're really honored and moved to be able to have the folks with us today who are on the panel. And just really appreciate the leadership that each of them has brought to indigenous struggles, to overall movements for collective liberation, and for taking the time to be with us today. So I'm just going to share a little bit about our panelists. And we also handed out a program that has their bios that people should have that has more information. So if there's any more of those extra bios around, we may have run out. If there's any extras or people can share, that'd be fantastic because it just gives a little bit more info. But to kick us off, we have Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, who's a longtime activist, university professor, and writer. She was a leading member of the women's liberation and anti-war movements of the 1960s and 70s. She worked with the American Indian Movement and the International Indigenous Movement and continues a struggle for indigenous self-determination and land. So real quick, let's give some love to Roxanne. Following Roxanne is going to be Randy Burns, who was a student activist at San Francisco State University, and in 1975 co-founded with Barbara Cameron Gay American Indians, an organization that serves the gay and lesbian Native American community. He has written widely about gay and lesbian American Indians and was a 2005 SF Pride Grand Marshal. Let's give some love for Randy. Randy will be followed by Kathy Chapman, who went on the longest walk in 1978, and in that process made a commitment with other walkers to make life better for American Indian communities and people. She produced Living on Indian Times on KPFA Radio from 1985 to 1995, and is currently an HIV case manager at the Native American Health Center of San Francisco. Closing out our panel is Roz Kadi, who's a co-founder of Snag Magazine, Seventh Native American Generation, and a host of Bay Native Circle on KPFA Pacifica Station 94.1. Roz is also a hip-hop artist whose third solo album, Street Prison, was chosen by East Bay Express readers as Best Local Album of the Year. So there was another person who was lined up, Nancy Hernandez, to be on our panel, but she had a last-minute cancellation. And so we really want to give a lot of appreciation to Kathy Chapman, who early on in this process of developing the panel was really helping us put it together. And then at the last minute, she took the call to come on the panel and be with us today. So we really appreciate that. And we also really appreciate... We also really want to appreciate Dixie Block, who was a Braden participant from last year, who put in a tremendous number of hours to help us put this panel together, reaching out to people who she's worked with over the years, and really bringing a lot of her political experience and leadership to helping Catalyst Project think more about how we're doing this session and be able to bring in particularly current organizing and youth organizing. So we also really want to appreciate Dixie. All right, y'all, you about ready for this? All right, so it's my honor to hand the mic on over here to Roxanne now.
He said, don't touch something, so if I touch it, you'll know, apparently. It's so nice to be here. I'm really happy to get to meet and get to know some of the ones of you enrolled and also the guests today, and then there are lots of my friends here I'm glad to see. I just wanted to say, following up on what Amy said about guilt, first of all, to say that I'm a descendant on one side of my family, of the hardcore white settler class, the Scots-Irish, who started out in the mountains, you know, squatting on Indian land, and then mostly were always landless and moved and ended up in Oklahoma, where my dad married a part Cherokee orphan. So she thought she was marrying a tenant farmer, a sharecropper. So that's my own background. So I'm not here to make anyone feel guilty, but just to, I personally think that knowledge can make you free, and it's really the only means to liberation. And what we do now is what counts, not what our ancestors did in the past, but what we do about changing the results of it. Well, I've been a teacher for a long time, and during three decades as a historian, I'm trained as a historian, teaching the introductory course in Native American Studies, which I set up at Cal State Hayward. I regularly required students to complete a specific research project, and that is to read or reread and analyze one U.S. history survey textbook in current use, assessing the treatment of Native Americans, looking for both distortions and omissions. And in this way, I've followed history textbook development in the period of multicultural revisionism, what many of us fought for in the 1960s in developing ethnic studies departments. This is the anniversary of San Francisco State, of UC Berkeley, and many others, including Cal State Hayward. And this way, I've followed these developments and see that it's really good to see that everything has changed, and I've watched it change. And it has changed for the better in most respects. There are now materials that go in depth about previously marginalized, the previously marginalized women, African Americans, Latinos, immigrants, and gays. It's not perfect, but these materials are available, as well as teachers who are from those communities. Native Americans, of course, have always been present in the nearly 200 years that led up to the founding of the United States in the textbooks, what is called the colonial period, as well as in the first century of the United States until the continent was secured under U.S. sovereignty. They were presented as obstacles to white settlement, finally overcome, after which they no longer appeared in textbooks. Well, multiculturalism has not really been useful, I think, for Native Americans. And most Native American scholars have turned to indigeneity and not multiculturalism. Multiculturalism has softened the image of the Native and made him a tragic and spiritual being from whom white people can learn, a clever people who invented all kinds of things useful to settlers and useful today, said to be contributions, such as corn, beans, squash, toboggans, tents, canoes, log cabins, parkas, and lacrosse, even democracy. Well, let me show you one of the results. These textbooks, by the way, are now being written by left-wing radicals who were in SDS, who got their doctorates and went into history, good people. This is four of them who did this book. It's called Out of Many, A History of the American People. It's got on the front a weave. So instead of the melting pot, we have a weave of peoples, which is somewhat better metaphor. But look at what they've done as a tribute to Native Americans to begin the book, if you can't see it. It's a Navajo woman at her loom, you know, the traditional loom, making a rug, and she's weaving a U.S. flag. And this was so horrified me. I was actually on a panel when they pulled this out. I was on a panel with two of the authors. And they said, well, it's a real picture. And I said, well, you know, these women make their living weaving rugs. For whatever, if you gave them a swastika, they would make it. It doesn't mean anything. And to their credit, they actually pulled the book from the shelves and did a new one. So it does take intervention, you know, but it's not automatic. It's never automatic when it comes to Native Americans. It's the knee-jerk, the default position is one of not making Indians visible in their reality. All of us know the fact that there were 13 original British colonies in North America that revolted against King George. These colonies hugged the Atlantic coast and went inland far less than the present states by the same names. You know, Massachusetts just went to, they all just went to the mountain ranges. Yet when I asked students the first day of class, and I could do it with you and it would happen, believe it or not, to quickly draw an outline of the United States at the time of independence, most of them draw the present continental form. I call this the Rorschach test of unconscious manifest destiny. It's quite telling and absolutely innocent. We know better, and yet the subconscious rules. It's not just white people who do that either, by the way. This is the way the origin myth of the United States works. It simply is the way things are. Destiny was manifest in the origin. While most U.S. citizens, and indeed the rest of the world, view the U.S. War of Independence as the first example of resistance to colonialism, right-wing, left-wing, liberal, they all agree. Even Afro-Caribbean revolutionary Frantz Fanon, in his Wretched of the Earth, made the same mistake. He wrote, "Two centuries ago, a former European colony decided to catch up with Europe. It succeeded so well that the United States of America became a monster in which the taints, the sickness, and the inhumanity of Europe have grown to appalling dimensions." In other words, it started out pure in a colonial revolt, and that he's telling Africans they shouldn't end up this way. But he's not understanding it started off as a colonizing power, not as a colony. Native Americans know better, of course. The United States was born as an empire, a breakoff from the British Empire. The War of Independence was not revolutionary. It was reactionary. Native people see the United States as imperialist from its founding, the most extensive colonial settler project in the 500-year history of European expansion, far greater than the British Empire in actual land occupied and settled. The Declaration of Independence thus did not end a colonialist venture that began in 1607 at Jamestown, but merely announced a change of flags. Well, the very first land laws, the Northwest Ordinance, mapped out the whole of North America from the East Coast to the West Coast as the goal. And this was before the Constitution was even written, before it was established as a government with the three branches of government and so forth. This land law, which became then a part of the plan, was a colonial plan for colonization of the whole continent. The invasions then and resistance that first took place after U.S. independence was between the Appalachian-Allegheny Mountains and the Mississippi River, and culminated in the mass forced removals of indigenous peoples to Oklahoma in the 1830s. Many trails of tears, not just for the Cherokee, but for the remnants of nearly 50 indigenous nations. This was a period of huge resistance, confederations, the best known being Tecumseh, and three wars the Seminoles fought for their freedom. Then you have the French Louisiana Territory that was bought from Napoleon. Here the Sioux and the Cheyenne, the Northern Plains people, and many other peoples had never been colonized by the French, only trading posts, and they also resisted the United States. But then the United States invaded Mexico and took half of it, and with that, right here, California, the gold rush began, and this is when the United States invaded the plains and began the war. During the U.S. Civil War in 1860 to 1865, the federal government was distracted from its campaign for a while. However, it did use the Union Army to remove the Navajos, from the Diné, from their alpine territory in northern Arizona, forcing them into a desert prison in southern New Mexico in 1864, half of whom died there, as well as sanctioning massacres of unarmed Cheyennes at Sand Creek in Colorado and the Sioux in Minnesota. You will never find these histories, that particular history, in any history of the Civil War. It's just ignored completely. At one time, the Union and Confederate armies fought on the same side, against the Apaches in New Mexico. So they're united, you know, Democrat, Republican, Confederacy, Union, but when it comes to Indians and the land there, they have the same policies. And this then expands around the world, if you notice, with foreign policy. They're rarely in disagreement. Soon after the end of the Civil War, the Federal Army's battle-experienced regiments, predominantly the black troops under black commanders that the natives call buffalo soldiers, invaded Sioux and Cheyenne territory. Even so, the indigenous were strong enough to make a treaty with the U.S. in 1868 that guaranteed their territory and sovereign rights. Soon after, the government broke that treaty. A new round of expansion and rush of settlers triggered the rise of new pan-Indian movements with Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull until they were both killed, and then we had the massacre of Wounded Knee in 1890. After that, after armed struggle was quieted, defeated, and Indians were locked up in reservations, not allowed to leave without passes, the Christian religious sects were brought in to pacify them, to missionize them, and the federal boarding school system was set up where they were not allowed to speak their own language and were taken from their homes far away and returned aliens to their really lost people, lost generations. So there was a brief period on the New Deal that that actually reversed allotment, which I didn't get to talk about, but the land was allotted, and three-fourths of Indian land was lost through allotment and sales of so-called surplus lands. That was stopped under the New Deal, and the Indian Reorganization Act recognized tribal governments. But this lasted only a brief time, and that was followed by a termination act to terminate all Indian, and this was part of anti-communism, the Cold War, that Indian collective ownership, the commons, the Indians owned, was communistic and had to be done away with. So this new attack actually, because about half the, and mostly young people, did leave the reservations, come to places like San Francisco, Chicago, Cleveland, Dallas, Phoenix, Los Angeles, and at a good time, you know, right during the Civil Rights Movement, where they got exposed to, you know, some of the sit-ins of the Civil Rights Movement took a little different term, terms like occupation of Alcatraz, and big sit-in at Wounded Knee, but land, you know, land and factory takeovers like Fairchild at the Navajo Nation. So this new attack produced a new generation of young activists in the cities, and this is what you know, Randy will talk about. I just want to end by saying historian Daniel Cobb, who has authored a wonderful book I very much recommend called Native Activism in the Cold War America, The Struggle for Sovereignty. He writes, and I think it's such an important point, the fact is that Native peoples have always engaged in political activism. Always, every minute since the beginning of colonialism. Whether or not it captured the imagination of the dominant society or penetrated the consciousness of public policymakers, the survival of indigenous languages and communities, the persistence of distinct identities, the protection of valuable resources, and the preservation of homelands have necessitated as much and are evidence of that political activism that very much continues today. Thanks so much.
Hi, my name is Randy Burns, and it's very rare I do public speaking, and if you read the bio, that's who I am, and it's an honor to be on the panel with Professor Roxanne Ortiz Dunbar. I've known for many years. I moved to the Bay Area in 1934, and what I would like to just begin by saying that it's my AIDS activist next to me, Ms. Chapman, and our new upcoming artist, Roz. So I just want to say it's an honor to be sitting up here on this panel. I've been at it for 34 years of my life, but at the beginning of time in the Navajo creation story, there's a story goes, and it's well documented, that most tribes in North America had gay and lesbian native people living in tribal society before the European contact. But at the beginning of the world, the Dene people believed that, and they welcomed the Nakle. The Nakle was, as we call it today, two-spirit, contemporary term I'll talk about briefly later. And the women wanted power. The women wanted power equal to men. And they had this big cat fight back then in the creation story of the Dene, and where they separated for 4 years. In the 4 year period, the turquoise boy or changing woman was created and welcomed and voted upon by the people to be part of that, the Navajo Nation as we know it today. So they were, after 4 years, of course, the women, everything that the woman did in that 4 year period, the turquoise boy did. Combed their hair, did pottery making, cooked for them, went to war with them, became a nurse like me, disabled nurse. So all the above that the women's role did, the other gender did, the two-spirit or the homosexual did equally and better. So when they came together after 4 years, it was agreed upon that they would be part of the Navajo Nation. In my tribe, Northern Paiute, and it's very common in the Great Basin, the Basque and Bow tradition is being revived by two-spirit spiritualists. Many people who don't live in the big cities but know a lot about the language, history, and culture of their people, especially in the Choban Nation, they're creating ritual again. They're creating tradition. In my tribe, when a person reached age of 12 or 13, puberty age, they were given the choice between a basket and the bow. The basket, of course, represented the female qualities that make the person special. The bow was manly or warrior-like. And so at the age of 12 or 13, and I don't know if any of you have been to a ritual in your own background, but if you picked up a basket, then that young boy, in this case, would have to, would be socialized to do all the female, feminine roles within that family or the tribe. If they picked up the bow, they became, of course, the hunter, warrior-like. So that's just from my perspective. And it's well documented more so today through gender studies on most campuses. And I think it's really important that we remember who we are. And this past year, we just sponsored a two-spirit wellness. And we talk about all these issues, and it's open to the public. And the t-shirt I'm wearing, Two-Spirit Wellness, they talk about the importance of health disparities, which includes language, history, and culture. And it's a time for Two-Spirit people or lesbian, gay, native people to come together, part of Pride Week, to celebrate who we are as individuals, as human beings. I think it's very important that we not forget where we came from. And this year's theme was reclaiming our place. And I wear many hats beyond what I used to do, and I'm good at. It's leafleting at 24th BART station in my campaigns many moons ago, 16th Street, Civic Center. I've leafleted. I've coordinated conferences. I know how to set up these chairs and take down these chairs. I know how to make fry bread. All the above. And with exception, I'm not an artist. But, you know, I've been in the role you're playing today in your communities. It's very important that there's a lot of similarities as community activists, as community organizers, or even promoters of our culture and our spiritualness. To me, it's dearly, and I value family. And one of the things I do with my family currently, and it started from the Coalfield Fire Plant. When you hear people talk about all these images you see on TV, the commercial about Coalfield Fire Plant, energy, let's live on the coal, well, that's very toxic. It's very toxic, and we, you know, where Burning Man takes place, that's a little small town 100 miles from Reno, Gerlach, Nevada. Well, we put a stop to it. Our family went on a war path. We were opposed to the contamination of a tablespoon, actually, of mercury would have killed our famous fish from Pyramid Lake. So we went on a war path against this corporation out of Los Angeles, and if there was a contamination spill, it would have impacted a 60-mile radius from that little small town of Gerlach where they wanted to build that. And it would have contaminated and killed our recreation for Pyramid Lake and killed the fish, but it also would contaminate a 60-mile radius. Small tribal governments, Fort Bidwell Indian Reservation, the Susanville Rancheria, Summit Lake Reservation, we all opposed to that Coalfield Fire Plant. So when the government, or you see commercials on TV, when they talk about Coalfield Fire, it's safe, it's not true. And what they wanted to do, we found out through a lot of grassroots organizing, our family did, is that it was on earthquake fault. Bad news bears. I grew up there. I used to jackrabbit hunt. I used to pick my wildflowers with family to do plant on Memorial weekends at our gravesite back in Fort Bidwell Indian Reservation and Pyramid Lake. So that lake in that area really means a lot to my tribal people. So when I'm out there, even now, they want to do wind power up where my grandfather's people are from, which is Mount Lassen County, not Mount Shasta, but it's in Lassen County. And they're talking about, you know, recognizing the Department of Interior, which is like a stem off BLM, it's called. They want to document the people that were from that area, descendants, and we come from that area. So, you know, I live in San Francisco, but I, like I said earlier, I wear many hats. And I just wanted to say that I moved here, like I said, 34 years ago, and I came and I was transferred from UNR. They didn't have ethnic studies, they didn't have women's studies, so when I got a chance to bring in my GPA, I transferred to San Francisco State, where they did have the School of Ethnic Studies. They did have women's studies. So that was my exposure and kind of got me more involved with people of color issues. At that time, it was called Third World. And I got recruited by the Equal Opportunity Program with Native American Studies Department. And I'm thankful for the student strike in 1969, this year. In November, we'll celebrate the 40th year of Alcatraz takeover part two. There were two takeovers. First takeover didn't go well with the media, but the second student-led takeover hit the world news, and there was an occupation at Alcatraz. So I'm part of that, and I'm honored to represent our Native community, not only the lesbian gay community. I'm an activist and a little politician for our Native community in San Francisco. And I've met my beautiful, good-looking mayor, and he kissed me when I was a grand marshal. So I think that's real good. But, you know, one of the things, you know, when I moved here, there were many gay and lesbian Native American people working in the art field. This is long before the AIDS epidemic, and many of us work at the old Indian Center. And we were all in the basement one time, and we were saying, well, why don't we, well, you know, we have the lesbian gay community. At the time, it was called the queer community or whatever, gay community, and controlled by white gay men in the Castro. And they didn't want to share power with the women's community or even the people of color community, at the time, Third World community. So we started up Gay American Indians. So next year we'll be celebrating our 35th year anniversary. And it became the cradle board for the Two-Spirit movement today across the nation, including Canada. And we just celebrated the 20th year anniversary of the Two-Spirit movement, and they rotate in Canada and the States. So in that process, of course, is research. and we publish books and videos on the subject. And if you read the bio, many of these books, Living the Spirit and Third Gender and the Zuni Princes, written and co-authored by Will Roscoe, is online with Amazon.com. So I just want to say to you, as an activist, as a queer Indian activist, I could proudly say that I'm up there meeting with the boys and boys, finally, heterosexual Indian men, equally at that table. And I don't take no for an answer. And that's what our club was based on. We are not going to take a backseat as queer Indians. And women, in my books, and I've been called a feminist, and I like that term. But, you know, I just want to say it's a lot about collaboration. It's sometimes you have to sacrifice. I didn't say kiss ass. But it's important that we stand our ground to reclaim our place, be it in our family, be it in our tribal communities. It's very important when you see a gay or lesbian Native person, you know, there are a lot of, I could go more on and on about protocol, but I think it's very important. I could look around the room. Believe me, I've been around the block. I could see who's queer. I could see all the little gay boys tripping out and kissing each other. I see you all. So you're in the room. I know that. But I'm honored to represent the gay and lesbian Native community, both locally and nationally. And some people call me grandpa. Cool. I've never been called an elder. Cool. Whatever that means. I don't know. I feel like I'm 16 and just coming out. So thank you. Thank you all.
Randy keeps everyone in line in the community and has done an amazing amount of work because he has put a face on Native people in the San Francisco community and not let any of the organizations or the city of county of San Francisco forget that we are there. So I want to thank him again for all the work that he does. My name is Kathy Chapman. I'm Chiricahua Apache and Yaqui. I'm second generation urban. I'm supposed to have been assimilated. Unfortunately, I didn't, I guess. My family came to LA in the early 20s before the 1934 Indian Reorganization Act. In Indian country, you know, you have a whole wide range of people that you know, we have intergenerational institutionalization of our people. We have people that were forced onto the reservation system. Some participated, some escaped. My family, our oral history is that on our Apache side, fled down to Mexico into the Sierra Madre and then came back. If you identified as an Indian person off the reservation during those years, you were tied up and thrown back on the reservation. And at San Carlos, where my people were from, you know, you have the government commodity system of food that was brought out, a lot of it rancid. A lot of the people there buried that food, you know, refused to eat it. They figured if the government was giving it to you, then it must not be good. And my father was of the mentality that you never take a government handout. So we have a whole range, and I know, Roxanne, when you spoke about, you know, the colonization, we have the colonization through the institutions, reservation system, boarding school, where people were tied up, forced to go to school, separated from their family, beaten for speaking their language. And making a disconnect in many families where some people were never able to, you know, connect back. Someone into the military, someone into the penal system. So there's been a breakdown of the original family structure in many communities. My grandmothers, we ended up in LA after my grandfather had died from TB on my father's side. My mother's family had already come, the Yaqui side. My grandmother, my Yaqui grandmother, supported herself by teaching music. You know, music It's really easy for her. She could play the guitar, the piano, the mandolin, and she supported herself by giving lessons in the community. My Apache grandmother worked as a nurse's aide, and she had come out on the railroad when her husband died because her brother worked on the railroad, and that's how they ended up in LA. So I'm supposed to be of the generation that assimilated, and I didn't. We moved from East LA, where my first experience in racism was when I was about 5 years old. We lived up on a hill on this area called El Sereno. Down the hill, we heard this big crash. And there was like this big old Studebaker, you know, those big heavy tank cars that was laying on its side. And this black woman was screaming, "My baby, my baby." And her infant was being crushed by this car. And my father tried to pick up the car. And there were lots of people around, lots of men around, and no one would help him try and pick up that car. And that was my first experience of people not wanting to help people of color. So, a few years after that, we moved to Orange County. So I grew up in Orange County, and that was very interesting. I never felt like I fit. And I graduated high school in 1970. And at that time, during the Vietnam War, you know, I was your typical high school, let's go get high and, you know, ditch class. One of my teachers kept giving me passes when they were discussing the war. And finally someone said, "Don't you know why he's giving you passes to the library?" And I said, "No, because he doesn't like what you're saying." So I started staying in class. And let's see, I moved up here. I think I left when I was 19. I moved up. I never felt like I fit. You know, I never fit in Southern California. I call it plastic land, you know, where you have to be chemically lobotomized in order to live in the smog. So I came up here, and long story, about 1978, I was only going to come to Oakland for a couple of months, do some work, get some money. And I ended up hearing about the longest walk. I couldn't go on the longest walk, but then I ended up just, you know, ditching my life and going on the longest walk, and it was the most intense experience of my life. And to be in a group of Native people who were walking towards D.C., and at that time there were 11 treaties that the government was trying to abrogate, do away with, on hunting and fishing rights, land rights. And so it was just an amazing experience to be walking into D.C. with, you know, thousands of Native people. And that was the first time I met the elders from Big Mountain. And these ladies were outrunning all the young men, you know, when they'd send runners out to go ahead. And that was the first time I had heard of that issue where they were relocating a lot of traditional Navajo people for energy development. And to go back a little bit, I don't know if you spoke about the relocation program of the 50s. In the 50s, they decided to send Native people into the urban areas, you know, to become more assimilated. That also opened up a lot of lands for energy development. That was sort of at the beginning. So a lot of us in D.C. made a commitment to go back into our communities, try and make life better. Very active Native community at that time. Intertribal Friendship House was sort of, you know, key. I came back and I lived at the AIM for Freedom Survival School, the AIM House in Oakland, and that's where my daughter Morningstar was born. And actually, I'm replacing Morningstar on this panel today. So, you know, we all have had to struggle, you know, and I personally, as a mother, don't want to see my daughter as an activist having to go through some of the same things that I've gone through. Through the years, I was also recruited to go into KPFA for the first apprenticeship program in 1985, and that was the first multicultural program at KPFA. where, you know, you can get the information out about your people. I was also recruited to work at our Native clinic. At that time, Highland Hospital had the third highest infant mortality rate in the nation, and each community, Latino, African American, Native American, Asian, they were recruiting women to become labor coaches, to be the medical bridge between the patients and the staff. We, in the late 60s and early 70s, our community, there was a lot of forced sterilization for the Puerto Rican and Native communities, so there was a lot of mistrust even going into our clinics. And Randy might have more information, but our Indian clinic was actually one of the demands of Alcatraz, because they relocated people here, but there wasn't the infrastructure to take care of them. And so it's always fighting, and it's like almost every 10 years. I'm so happy that, like, Dixie, it works on the Big Mountain issue that I used to work on. And at that time, those elders, you know, they said, my generation, the urban ones, you know, we're the ones with the roots cut off. So we have to really work to, you know, to make those connections. And I wanted to make sure that I brought my children up, you know, within their community to have that cultural foundation. And I'm so happy that Ross does the work that he does. I was so happy to come back from Arizona and hear him on the radio, because he is the seventh generation. You know, he is the one that we have done this work to try and save. And I've got 5 more minutes. I wanted to tell you there's a movie coming out with Charlie Hill. You can go to clubredwithcharliehill.com. It's a Native comedy program, but it has some good pieces. He's going to be in a movie called Real Indians, where it sort of addresses the stereotype of Native people in film, and I think it's a really good learning tool. I'd also like to say that a lot of people don't know how casinos came into being. In the late 60s and early 70s, the federal programs that were supposed to be promised to Native people were being cut back, and, you know, it's like, you have to become self-sufficient, you have to become self-sufficient. So that's how casinos came in, and casinos are taking care of people in ways that haven't, you know, to create the infrastructure that wasn't there before. In some communities are just giving it back in per capita payments to people, but some people are buying back all their traditional lands. I wanted to say one thing about one of the elders at Big Mountain, where there's been just a lot of violence against the traditional people. One of the elders, Catherine Smith, she says that we continue to be the thorn in the side of the United States government. So is that it? Okay. And Ross.
Yes. What do you want me? How you guys doing? I'm just going to stand up so I could point to some of these slides and stuff like that. But my name is Ross. I'm from Snag Magazine. We teach Native youth different forms of media. We print a full-color magazine, which we have some back here in the table back there. Teaching youth various types of media skills, video, magazine layout, production, screen printing, all kinds of stuff. We work in San Francisco. And also we have 2 programs that were going on in San Francisco last year. We have another 2 programs starting in San Francisco. And we had a satellite program on Robinson Rancheria and the reservation, which is up in Lake County, which is a photography program. And this is one of our kind of, ideas that started at the U.S. Social Forum. How many of you guys went to the U.S. Social Forum? back in Atlanta. A lot of you guys were there. This is kind of like the baby that was birthed over there. Was this idea to go to Palestine. We've been doing work with Palestine Israel Education Project out of New York for the last 2 years, doing education around Palestine and collective education around indigenous struggles and how indigenous colonization and Palestine can kind of relate to each other. And so we are kind of, you know, we wanted to be a part of changing the conditions, be a part of affecting colonialism happening right now somewhere else, and, you know, creating mutual solidarity between both the groups. And so we decided that we were going to go on this trip to Palestine, take an indigenous youth delegation to Palestine. So I'm going to show you some of our slides from our trip. And this is kind of thrown together last minute, so hopefully, and there's a lot of information there. We'll try to go through it as quickly as possible. But no, just so you guys, this see our group is up there. There's about 15 of us. We're from Kansas, the Bay Area, and New York. And down here in this bottom slide is over in Qalqilya, and that was actually right after we were shot at. And we originally thought it was a sound bomb, but it was actually, we found out later that our tire had a bullet inside of it. And so we actually shot at, and we actually got out and stood next to the wall, right next to the sniper tower where they shot from, and just continued our tour of the wall in Qalqilya, which is basically a town that is a Palestinian town, which is surrounded by walls on all three sides, and there's only one way in. Shadi's actually put this PowerPoint together. I just helped a little bit. But on the left side, you see this is kind of like going to like talking about shared struggle. And on the left side, you see a wounded knee. A couple of the panelists talked about wounded knee. And one more thank you to all the panelists here for all their work and all their history that they shared today. But Wounded Knee was 1973, and then also on the other side is Janine. This is the martyr wall of some of the people that were killed in Janine uprising, and a lot of the Palestinian people believe in resistance, violent resistance, or militaristic resistance, and. So we put these two slides together to kind of show some of the more ways that we shared struggle. And go to the next slide. This is also I'm gonna show some of the slides and make some comparisons, and some of the slides I'm not gonna compare to at all. But this is also another slide which shows of. On this side, is this wounded, the original wounded knee, right? No, it's not original wounded knee. Well, this is just as you see up top, the cavalries, a lot of them in the U.S. Were volunteer cavalries put together by, most of them were started because of actual laws that were put in place, extermination laws in a lot of different states. In California, extermination laws started from about 1852, and they lasted until like 1910. For instance, in California, the extermination laws, paid for execution of California natives. So in 1 year in 1855, the California state paid over $1 million for the extermination of native people here, which would mean that, you know, they would post a sign up in town and the cavalry would go out and exterminate native peoples. And just volunteers from the community would go out and they would kill native peoples and bring their ears. Ears were 25 cents, and a whole head was $5. And so you can imagine how many heads and ears were produced. So then on this side is also in Gaza, 2009, the last bombing right before the Bush administration was on their way out. Killed more than 1,300 people, one third were children. And so we wanted to make a comparison to this because we felt like, this is just a shared experience of like extermination. And then the relocation, which a lot of them have talked about, Indian relocation, Trail of Tears, A lot of people don't know about the relocations in California, but there's a book called The Round Valley Wars, which talks about six tribes that were relocated in California into Round Valley or Covelo. And that's a really good book describing some of the tribes in California that have been relocated, forcibly relocated. This one shows the Trail of Tears, the Indian Removal Act of 1830. And then also on this side, down below, 80% of Palestinians and what was declared Israel in 1948, where British mandate became refugees living someone outside of Palestine, historic Palestine. This was a village that was that we visited. It's in Jerusalem. As you can see, there's a bunch of settlers swimming in what used to be a Palestinian village. And they're basically recreating here. And we were with an elder who was actually grew up in the village, and he was 8 years old when his family was forcibly removed. And he thought that they were just going to come back, you know, maybe a few months later, and they haven't been back since. He's about 75 or so now. This is also another village. The woman standing up top, Arij, her family's village, is the picture below. She's standing in front of national parks, and one of the ways that colonization actually has happened, not only here in the U.S., a big way that the land was colonized here in the U.S. and also in Palestine was by creating these national parks. And I think she explained a lot about the national park system and how people were basically given away trees and things that at family for, you know, buying things for their families, trees and other things for their families, and they would plant them here in these national parks and basically created these whole national parks. And down below is Deir Rafat, which is Arija's village, which as you can see has a big olive orchard on it, and actually is being harvested by a Bedouin community who is still living there and actually has to pay like $2,000 rent every 3 weeks. So her family can't return there. She's actually not even allowed to go there. We snuck her in with us. this is actually a new film, PBS, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. And so this describes basically the percentage of land which have a bunch of like sacred sites, traditional ceremonial places for Native peoples. There's about 9 parks in California that have traditional, or maybe more, national parks that have ceremonial places, actually ceremonial houses still in them that used to be villages that were occupied. And now it's actually illegal for most of us to go back and actually practice our ceremonies there, or build a fire, or do our ceremonies there. And this is actually an Israeli national park, which is named American Independence Park. And American Jews, like I said, are encouraged to give each other gifts in the form of trees and those type of things to plant these national parks. And this is a description of the percentage of the land. Oh, he's gonna change it. Are we going too fast? Can you guys read all the slides, or should I slow down? It's okay. All right. I'm trying to move fast. I know we're on time limit here. So, like I was saying about the national parks, one of the ways that the land was occupied here, I call this the occupied states of America, was through the use of national parks. As you can see, 67, almost 70% of the land is not in use, or not lived on. It's in national parks, and so and then 2% of that land in the U.S. is entrusted to the tribes. And the similar statistics for Israel. So you can kind of see where some of these ideas are starting to come from, right? And on the right side, you have a school, which was a school that was created to assimilate the tribes in the south and the Northwest Plains. This was Haskell University, which was actually, it's a university now, but back then it used to be more of a kind of like a, kind of like what the mission system was for California. Basically steal children from their villages, bring them here. A lot of them actually, some of these children that are here are probably actually in the grave site that's on campus. There's, I think, almost 200 students, so-called students that are actually in the gravesite there, and there's, I think, one child that was maybe like 3 years old. So it was a really, really horrendous place, and actually the natives that over the years have reclaimed it and made it into a university. And this is an example on the left of a tribal Indian card, and I'm going to talk about that in the next slide, actually. So there's me with my federally issued federal ID card. And a lot of people don't know this, but if you're a tribal member, you're born into a political identity here in the U.S. I'm born with my ID number, which is, I can't read there, but I think it's 515114 is my federal ID number that's issued from birth. And a part of this system was to monitor my blood. And so that way the U.S. government could reduce their trust responsibility to the tribes, which was guaranteed to us through our treaties. And I'm not gonna go really too deep into that, but as you can see up top, reservations in U.S., the purple areas are the tribal lands. As you know, the rest of the U.S. As now how it exists now. On the top is a pre-contact in California, the traditional areas, traditional territories of the California Native peoples and the tribes here. And on the right side, you see the reservations there and the purple dots. And so that's the land that is collectively owned or actually owned in trust from the federal government now today. And the same here as well, Palestine 48, historical Palestine on the left. And then going down to the right, all the full right side, you see Gaza on the left corner there, and on the right side is West Bank, what is now West Bank, split into A, B, and C sections. This is also a youth holding his passbook or his, it's kind of like a, I guess it's kind of like what they used in South Africa, the passbook system. To basically divide and it's a way to restrict movement as well. So a lot of this actually in this camp, Shufat is surrounded by two checkpoints and a big wall. And the youth until they're 16, they can go in and out into Jerusalem. Once they reach the age of 16, they can't leave, and they're forced to stay within the perimeters of that camp. So this is, you can relate this also to the mission system and the way that the native peoples from 1763 and to 1830s were treated here in California. They weren't allowed to leave the missions, brought to the mission system, and forced to stay there. But with higher technology, they have like these hand scanners and like these, they're installing these like retina readers and things like that. So it's really crazy. Living under apartheid, this youth right here was actually telling his story about, he came up to us and he's like, yeah, let me tell you my story. And he showed us this wall back here, and he was talking about his home that was right here next to the wall, and the people that were trying to destroy his home for the security of the wall, because the home was too close to the wall. And so there's a bunch of homes, actually, you can't really see them in the frame, but they're just foundations that were closer to the wall that were destroyed. So lastly, I'm gonna go through these slides really quick because I'm running out of time, but as you can see on the left side, some of the dances, traditions, cultural practices that were prohibited under U.S. law for Native peoples on this side. On the right side, you see a list of some of the desecrated sites, some of them being the Bay Area or surrounding areas, the Shell Mound in Emeryville, where there's 30,000 remains there, right here in East Bay, Medicine Lake Highlands, Pitt River land in the north, Cave Rock in Nevada. And the reason we kind of make a comparison here is this is actually a mosque that was built atop Prophet Muhammad's burial site. And as you can see, this woman has to go through the checkpoint and be harassed and searched and just to go pray. This old man as well, he's entering the mosque. The Palestinians that we were with, that we brought with us from Dehesha and from Balata, or from Shufa, I mean, were out actually being harassed as we went in. The soldiers were calling them bitches and other names. And so just some of the harassment that they have to go through just to get into the mosque where they're supposedly praying. There's also a camera here in the top inside the mosque. And this is, we'll just go through these really quickly because I think we're out of time. But this was another mosque in Lifta that was actually vandalized by Israeli graffiti. And it used to be a mosque. It used to be the traditional village there. This is our magazine and what we do, educating around media. And a picture there of natives, you know, being empowered through education. And lastly, this is the Wintu tribe, who's actually suing the U.S. government for destruction of their sacred sites through the dams and other things, and suing for recognition as well, because they're not a recognized tribe of California. And that down below is a NAGPRA protest demanding the remains be returned, because that's actually at Cal, UC Berkeley. And they have over, I think, 10,000 remains of indigenous, or 15,000 remains of indigenous people inside the vaults down below. And actually, it's really hard to go in there. We have to end, but you wanna go to are we out of time, or we still have a couple more slides? All right, so this is some of the workshops that we did, or actually this is Bay Omar, and this is Dubka. So this is like some of the things that the youth are doing to resist. And this is actually some Dubka dancing, traditional dancing. And this is some of our workshops that we did with three refugee camps in Balata, Shufat, and Dehesha. This is in Dehesha. Did a mural, some photography. I did a music workshop, and there was also a screen printing workshop as well. Another. Some of our workshops with the magazine and some of the stuff we produced, the blogs that we created and the writing that we created, one of our writing workshops and magazine layout workshop. And the key as the symbol for the right of return for them to return to their indigenous homelands. Next one. And if you want to support the delegation, you can go to our website, indigenousdelegation.wordpress.com. We kind of are in the red as far as our funding. So if you guys want to help support, or we actually want to be sending a bunch of equipment back to Palestine for photography, like cameras, if you want to donate a camera or anything. And we want to send some music equipment back as well to upgrade their studio so they can bang out some new music. Whatever you can do helps. Thank you.
Let's give some big appreciation and gratitude for all of our panelists. We have about 20 minutes for question and answer. So if people want to just kind of take a minute, sort of take it in. This was a lot of information, a lot of history of colonization, history of resistance, a lot of what's going on right now in Palestine and in what's known as the U.S. So people just kind of want to take that in, take a minute to sort of let it sit and percolate. And then I think what we'll do is take two or three questions at once and then just let the panelists kind of respond to whatever moves you. So does anybody have questions? And I can just raise your hand if you do, and I'll bring the mic over for you. Oh, great. Okay. Great. Should I wait? Go ahead. Okay.
I just
want to
say that.
Hold on, we're just. Can I take this? Not working. So anybody else have questions? Just one or two more? Yeah.
Yo. Okay. You want to say your question again?
Does somebody want to comment on the recent federal denial of Leonard Peltier's parole the other day? And how the prison system is connected to the boarding school or missions that have happened in here.
Okay, we had a question over here.
I was hoping that you could connect some of the work that you're doing and the struggles in what's called the United States to the Americas in a larger sense, in the context of a lot of indigenous-based struggles that are emerging and coming to new heights in the Americas overall.
Okay, we'll start with those.
I just want to say on Friday, if you read the San Francisco Chronicle, the corporate paper of America, on Friday, there was in the map section the decision to turn down his appeal. And basically, in a quote that was spread at the American Indian Street Fair in San Francisco yesterday, the word went like prairie fire. Pardon the pun there. Prairie fire, like the moccasin hotline. Well, anyway, basically what Leonard had to say about his rejection in his turned down by the court was that he said, it's not for me, Leonard, it's for all political prisoners. And I think it's real important to remember that, because all of us, when we do community organizing, community activism work, we cross many borders. Immigration, land, burial protection, sacred site protections. So at any given time, we're on the longest walk, we like it or not, or maybe we're not aware of it, but all of us are peace activists at heart, but our work is 24/7 for me, and I take my volunteer work back home, be it on the reservation or in the big city of San Francisco. I take my work very serious, and I just want to just show you, if anybody wants to see my tribal card, I have a pretty tribal card. So anyway, but with this tribal card, that means I can't vote in tribal elections because I don't live on the reservation. I have to live 160 days. Indian Health Service have a policy in Nevada. You have to live 160 days for dental or any kind of medical work. So I have to move back to the reservation to live for 160 days. That's a government policy for you. And the other thing, with health, education, benefits, I, again, have to live on the reservation for to get any higher education grants to go to school. So, you know, this card is pretty. You know, why don't you just take my ATM card while you're at it? It's just plastic. Thank you.
I wanted to touch on something in Ross's slideshow when you were talking about the IDs, because according to the DMV, the California DMV, a tribal ID card, a certificate of Indian blood, is acceptable as a form of ID. So this last week, we had a patient who's from the Navajo Nation, has his Navajo Nation original birth certificate, has a certificate of Indian blood, But the Navajo Nation, a sovereign entity within the U.S., has decided not to use the Department of the Interior. Unfortunately, they didn't inform California DMV. So for 2 days, we tried to get this man a California ID. And now we have to wait and get a letter from the Navajo Nation stating what I just said, that they, because DMV says you have to have Department of the Interior certificate of Indian blood. This is some of the obstacles that Native people have to go through. And you had something up there on the freedom of religion. And in 1978, it wasn't until 1978 that Native people were allowed to practice ceremonies openly. So many people have come to the United States for religious freedom, but the original people of this land could not practice openly until 1978. I also want to touch on the fact that there are so many nations of Native people in California and across the U.S. There's only over 400. And so Richard West, of the outgoing director of the Museum of the American Indian, he said something that has really impacted me over the years, and that's that we embrace the similarities and we honor the differences amongst us as Native people. Because so many, especially in the stereotypes, see everyone as plains or as Southwest, Pacific Northwest, California. Everybody has a unique and different culture. And so we always try and honor that, you know, that not everyone does everything the same way.
Well, this thing about, it's a really good question of the connection between the prison system and the boarding schools. I think Kathy actually mentioned how the board, maybe it was Roz, but how the boarding schools were set up as a almost like a military style. They were founded by a general, Pratt, and they were set up militarized, the girls and the boys. And so institutional, you know, when people are institutionalized, as people here who've been in prison for a while know and have seen prisoners, there's a kind of a dependency that develops, you know, and so either the army or prison, I mean, there's a, it's an almost a natural step. That also the kind of rebellion that comes from bucking that system, which is probably more prevalent among Indians, and so they end up, so you have horrible statistics, like in Gallup Jail or Sandstone, the state prison in South Dakota, where you have a population of, say, 2% Indians in the state in South Dakota, and you have 80% of the prison population are Lakota, you know, or Sioux people. So that's, you know, it's very much like the African-American statistics, only it's more regionally based. And then there are the federal prison system, of course, many Indians are tried in. So I think that's a really good question and a good connection to make, and it's something I'd like to see some of your students do more research on, making, you know, documenting that. Claude asked about the struggle in the Americas. This is something I've been working on for the last 35 years with the international indigenous movement and seen it grow. Evo Morales' mother was involved in, you know, in Treaty Council stuff and in the international, the present president of Bolivia. So he's like, he's sort of like Roz. He's a child of that movement, and they've been interconnected. So it is so inspiring and such a support system, where we now have actually states in the United Nations that identify as Indian, like Bolivia, Venezuela, which is a smaller Indian population but is very well connected with the Indian movement, is also very supportive. We haven't had that before. So most of you know that 2 years ago, a Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People was passed by the UN General Assembly, and is a powerful document. You can find it online very easily. and it's something that is useful to every Native community, really in the world, but especially in the Americas. So I thank you for those two questions. Are we going to have another round?
We have time for one more questions. Two hands in the back. I do, I feel just like Oprah.
I just wanted to ask about the role that protecting sacred sites plays in Indigenous movements, and also, I guess, I have two questions. What, like, local issues here are going on that folks can get involved with?
And my question was just around how in the U.S., Native communities have always been at the forefront of struggles for, for ecological justice. And right now, as climate change is becoming all more encompassing and green stuff is becoming really trendy in the mainstream, I'm wondering how the different communities that y'all are connected to are shifting to that political space or adapting to that political shift.
I guess I could take the first couple questions on... I think for most tribes, I think the overall like general belief is that all the land is interconnected with our way of being, and so all the land is sacred. It's all stolen. It's all being occupied, and historically, as environmentally, has been destroyed in a lot of communities, especially like in the Bay Area, for instance. We've had mining. And most of the battles and most of the wars and resistance that has happened has been because of resources, because of mineral rights, including water, including different minerals, uranium, coal, gold in California, one of the biggest ones here. The mercury pollution that was created from the gold mining alone here in California is one of the really big issue. And you have about six or seven rivers here in California that have been really polluted from the mercury tailings from the mines here in California. You can get a lot of more information about that. There's a good film, Gold Green Genocide, which kind of talks about the mercury and the environmental stuff that has happened. That's a really good issue to also get involved with here. There's a couple other issues around sacred sites. The Shell Mound issue that I talked about in Emeryville. Thanksgiving Day, there's a whole campaign and a whole group of folks that go out there every day, every Thanksgiving. And, it's the whole big Thanksgiving sale or whatever they have. And I don't know if it's Thanksgiving Day or the day after Thanksgiving, but one of the two. And they basically protest people shopping. And remind people that they're shopping on a burial site. That'd be a good thing to go support. Also, the Alcatraz, the 40th anniversary coming up in November. It's a good place for you to go support and also experience a bunch of beautiful cultural dances and traditions that keep on going. And then also there's actually a Shell Mound Walk, which is really good. That happens every, I think, October, coming up pretty soon, which will take you from the Bay Area here to San Francisco and all around to San Jose and Vallejo, all around the Bay, and it's a big walk where they walk to all the sacred sites, and you'd be surprised at where a lot of these sacred sites are. Like the Marina in San Francisco has a lot of sacred sites. San Jose, some of the even the like just suburban neighborhoods have like sacred sites, burial sites in them, where traditional villages were. And so that's a really good walk to take to educate yourself about the Ohlone people, the Miwok people, some of the original peoples from this land. The second question, I think I covered environmental stuff, but maybe you want to say more, anyone?
You know, I think one of the things that it's a privilege to live in the Bay Area because you meet many people, like Kathy said, the keyword is similarities. and we come from different cultures and backgrounds. And one of the sacred sites in Lake Tahoe area is called Cave Rock. And it was pursued by an Apa reservation families of the Washoe tribal membership, and they pursued it into the federal court. And so that site in itself, no more rock climbing, is one issue. But like brothers said over here about Shale Mound, walk happens from Emeryville all the way down south up to San Francisco. And the Ohlone people is one of many tribes historically from this area. You had the Miwok, and you also had the Pomo. And there are 13 colonies of the Pomo band, I believe, that's recognized now, not only for bingo at one time, but their casino tribes, another issue. But in Nevada, where I'm from, Pyramid Lake, we have Burning Man. If you ever want to go up to Burning Man, Labor Day weekend, look for my food booth. I'm going to be making fried bread. But one of the things what's nice about burners, when they go out past to our reservation, not only they support the tribal food vendors, but they also leave the land. It's a 2-mile radius where they have the wheel, where it's like a bicycle spoke. But when they leave that area, it's pristine. And to me, if someone told me recently if they were doing a PhD, that would be a good thesis to write about, because it is protecting Mother Earth in respect to our native Paiute people about burial sites in the Granite Rock, Black Rock Desert, and Arrowhead's Flint City for days. Not Detroit, Flint. Black obsidian rock can be found. And our people, the people that travel to the area, the Shoshone and the Paiutes, that was their home base. But when burners come through, they do respect the land. And they give back by giving our tribal facilities, our high school, our tribal court, our tribal buildings, all solar. Public high school and our elementary school is being supported by Black Rock Desert Foundation, which is Burning Man, quote, corporation now. So if you have a lot of money, please come my way. I'll be making fry bread. Thank you.
Actually, I think Dixie would be a better person to talk about Big Mountain, but one of the issues in California is Medicine Lake. My children are Achamawi Pit River from up by Mount Shasta, and one of my concerns with Medicine Lake is that a geothermal plant is on the lake is really going to, is creating a lot of ecological damage. But within the last year, there's been sort of this media disinformation on clean coal. You know, coal burning is looked at as clean energy. And I would really like to see some of you become involved with addressing that issue. Where Big Mountain is around Black Mesa, there's been a forced relocation of the elder Navajo people in order to strip mine the coal. And it's caused destruction, health issues. In the Southwest, organ cancer rates are 17 times the national average. Homicide, suicide, you know, heart disease, everything is like 10 times the national average. So, what's that?
Well, just about the sacred sites, I was glad that Roz put those statistics up about the national parkland and land that is owned and controlled by the federal government. And that doesn't even include a lot of the state lands, like in New Mexico, between the two, federal and state. They control about 90% of it. So one of the things that the Pueblos, mainly in New Mexico, talk about is restoration of that federal land. It really only takes the stroke of a pen by the executive. A lot of these are executive order federal. And this was Theodore Roosevelt, who's being celebrated right now in a 1,200-page book that is number one bestseller in the New York Times on Theodore Roosevelt establishing not only Mount Rushmore, you know, the ugly faces of presidents carved into the sacred Black Hills, but to all of the other parks he established, and many have been established since then. Every single one of these, they were carefully chosen, researched, for what are the sacred sites of Native peoples. It was like the French say the coup de grace, you know, it was the final blow of colonialism in terms of trying to break the back of the spirituality of the Native nations by taking those sacred sites, Yosemite, Grand Canyon, the Grand Tetons, all of them, of course, the Black Hills, you know, and Mount Rushmore, and some of them are state parks. There's a sacred site in Georgia of the original Cherokees before they were removed, and they were trying to reestablish this as a sacred site back in the 1970s. And the National Indian Youth Council, the head of it then was a Cherokee, he took it to court and they didn't get anywhere about protecting spirituality. But some people did research and found that there was a little creature called a snail darter that would be endangered by a dam that was being built. What was that dam called? A Calico Dam or something like that. And so the snail darter was protected in that way. The Indian spiritual location was protected. So that caring more, you know, for the creature, and that's fine to care for the creatures, but to also, you know, understand that these are big holes in people's cultures, these things not being accessible. And thermal sites are among, like, Khoisan Hot Springs and others where they're trying to build thermal energy. This, too, is, you know, a real blasphemy to the sacred sites.
My Garfield. So let's just give one more great big round of applause and appreciation. Thank you so much to all of our panelists for being here today, and I'm going to turn it over to Molly, who's going to talk about some other ways that folks can support Indigenous organizing.
So thank you so much to our panelists. That was fantastic. Who in here heard something that you were moved by, that you were inspired by today? All right, let's make some noise. So I just want to say I learned a ton. I'm really excited to see that many of you have, and there's going to be ways for us to continue talking together about what we learned. I also really appreciated those questions about how do we give back concretely? How do we support the work that we've heard about today, the resistance struggles that are still going on, struggles for justice. And one of the ways that we want to just offer today is by giving back financially. So we're going to just be passing some boxes around. They look like that. One over there that Luke has, hold it up, and this one here. And there's about 110 people who came out today to hear this panel. So that means if everyone gives between $5 and $20, we can raise between $500 and, what's that, $2,000 for four organizations that these panelists have chosen to continue the struggles that they're a part of. So the organizations, I'm just going to read you a little bit about what they're about. So one of them is the Intertribal Friendship House in Oakland. It was established in 1955 as one of the first urban American Indian community centers in the nation. They provide crucial services to the multi-tribal indigenous community in the Bay Area. So that's the Intertribal Friendship House. We're going to be splitting all the donations four ways, just so folks know. The next one is the Two-Spirit Wellness Conference. Brings together Native people from around the country to share experiences of health, wellness, recovery, healing, and to build community. And the third organization is Honor the Earth. Honor the Earth works to raise public awareness and raise indirect funds to grassroots Native environmental groups. They're the only Native organization providing both financial support and organizing support to Native environmental initiatives. And the last one is Circle of Healing, which does HIV services at the Native American Health Center in San Francisco, who just suffered some really major budget cuts. So if you're able today to put some money in the box, we really appreciate it. It goes directly to support the work that these folks are involved in and are asking us to support. You also heard a bunch of other ways to get involved. So if you heard something you're interested in, you can talk to the panelists during the break, potentially. Look it up on the internet, stuff like that. So I'm going to pass it over to Chris to talk a little bit more about what's happening now.
So these are also all organizations that the panelists chose to have money go towards, and just really hope that we're able to break the $1,000 to split amongst these organizations. So we're about to take a break, but for a whole bunch of folks who are guests to the Ann Braden program, we have a space to continue the discussion, and Savannah and Dixie are two of the people that have helped to create this space. And they're gonna tell us a little bit more about what it is.
Hey there, my name's Savannah and this is Dixie. And just for those of us who are not in the Ann Braden program, we're gonna head over to a house, it's just two blocks away, so we can continue the conversation, get folks connected with more resources, and hang out and eat some food. So if anyone's interested, the address is 513 28th Street, just a couple blocks away.
Yeah, and I just wanted to go over some of our guest space goals of this get-together. We have a loose agenda. We really want to just get to know each other and connect a little bit more. We want to find out why some folks are here. So some of the goals are give guests an opportunity to continue discussing the main themes and issues raised on the panel. Give guests an opportunity to meet other people and build with people in the Catalyst community. And give guests a proactive vision of anti-racist work. And for those who want it, there's resources to learn more. And about resources, we're going to have these at the guest space. And they're also at the back table. And listed in here are a number of sacred sites and how to get involved. Thank you. Thank you so much, Catalyst. Thank you to the panelists, too.
So thank you all so much for coming out today and being a part of this open session. And one more time, let's just give love to our panelists. So we're now going to move into a break, and so just again to reiterate what that means is that we're just asking all the folks who are guests, who we're so happy and thankful that you were able to make it today, that the guest space, as Savannah and Dixie said, is a couple of blocks from here, and then, or if you want to just head out for the day, but back in this space in about 15 minutes, the Ann Braden participants are going to be coming back together to continue the day with workshops following up from the panel. So thank you again so much for coming out, and we look forward to seeing you all in the future.
If you want to support Snag Magazine, there's some magazines back there as well with Shadi. Shadi, raise your hand back there. We have some magazines, also some of my music as well.